So we start today, last session today. It's going to be the presentation of Professor Aim Pantnik, and he's a senior lecturer in the Bachmann Faculty of Law in Tel Aviv University. His research interests are divided between issues of evidence and proof, including statistics, causation, and free will, and issues of substantive criminal law, focusing mainly on sexual offenses, consent, and prostitution. Professor Emmett has published in leading peer-reviewed journals such as the Modern Law Review, Oxford Journal of Legal Studies, Toronto Law Journal of Law and Philosophy. In addition to Tel Aviv, Emmett has also taught Cambridge, Oxford, and Cornell, and Warsaw. So, Professor, you have 40 minutes, and I will tell you 5 minutes before.
Okay, yeah, that's okay, thank you. Good. Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to stand if that's okay. So I'm afraid I haven't come as prepared as I wanted, teaching and all of the rest of the excuses. But before beginning, I want to start with kind of a personal note. I've been working on this issue of statistical predictive evidence for I think now is probably 15 years, and I'm a bit fed up with it, and I want to leave the topic and move on. And this is basically my farewell party. But now, in order to make things worse, now look about how consistent and sensible I am. I think the best way to go out with a bang is to try to put a book proposal on the topic and get it done with, put everything I want out and live it. So one of my tasks for the coming month, now that I don't teach, would be to think about this proposal more seriously. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to come here, not only because it's my second time in Girona and it's so far being great as previous and probably even better, but also because I kind of have a new direction that I want to take with the project, a new angle, an egalitarian kind of perspective on the topic that I want to test on you at the very end. So this was not part of the paper that I distributed, but something I consider writing. And I'd be grateful for any feedback or thoughts or
protest. So you're fed up with the topic, but you're writing another paper and a book about it.
Yes, exactly. That's,
I already have a question.
So this is just kind of the preliminaries. Wait until you hear my views. So basically, that's basically the plan. Let's go on to talk about the topic itself. So the topic, you've heard kind of a bit about it when David spoke, but the idea here is to talk about a certain phenomenon that I think I found very puzzling, that if you look at justice systems, mainly in, I'm familiar with common law jurisdictions, but I think it probably extends to continental systems as well, you find that what I call predictive evidence, which I will explain in a minute what it is often ignored when the court tries to determine whether the accused committed the alleged crime. So at a factual stage, at the judgment stage, not at the sentencing stage. So what is this distinction based on? Basically, I work with a universe distinction between trace evidence and predictive evidence. Trace evidence being evidence created by the event itself. So for example, if I murdered someone, the body is trace evidence because that's the crime or the event created the evidence. While predictive evidence is evidence that tries to look into the past, into previous sets of events or a certain population or a certain characteristic within a population of either people or events and try to predict based on previous trends whether the alleged offense is likelier or less likely. So that's basically the distinction. Again, the direction is different. Again, looking from the event to the evidence created by the event, or alternatively, looking from the previous the evidence before the event, something that suggests that the alleged event is more likely. So that's the distinction I work with. And I want to also highlight that I work on, I'm interested in kind of a different angle than what most of the epistemologists and many other legal scholars are working on. Usually people are concerned, or many of the people working on this are traditionally concerned with the problem of sufficiency. So why shouldn't we convict solely on predictive evidence? And there are some basically famous examples, the prisoners in the yard and so on, that try to illustrate that problem. I'm interested in the question of admissibility, of why the court doesn't even willing to hear about this evidence, why the evidence is not used as a matter of course in courts and in criminal courts at least. And to take kind of the example that for me is the key example, if we look on a particular neighborhood and if we see that people who live in this particular neighborhood are, let's say, 10 times likelier to commit a particular offense, a particular violent offense, then why shouldn't the prosecution be allowed to use that evidence in addition to many other evidence that they might be able to present to bolster their case that it is beyond reasonable doubt that the accused committed a crime. So the question is again not about whether this evidence in and of itself should suffice to convict, but whether we should even be willing to hear about it. And it's quite interesting because if you think about almost any other context, we usually are willing to hear about that evidence. So if somebody is coming to a hospital and we look on the kind of base rates, it might be, at least arguably, something that we might be willing to take into account. We also find the kind of a wider hostility within the criminal courts toward that sort of evidence, and I get examples of previous convictions and bad characters, which are traditionally, although recently there are some reforms in various countries and more willingness to accept them, but in general there's kind of a hesitation or reluctance to make that sort of inference, and we get to other examples, but I'm going to focus mainly on kind of the hypothetical crime rate example, which I think for me is most puzzling. So, I want to make three claims in general, and the paper start by doing that. And the first is that the hostility of the criminal fact-finding toward that sort of evidence could be explained by an implicit adherence to a certain view, a certain view about free will. And according to that view of free will, culpable actions, actions that are subject to attributions of culpability are unpredictable, and I will explain very soon what do I mean by unpredictable. So that's the first claim, which is kind of trying to explain or propose an explanation for why the courts are hostile to that kind of evidence. The second claim I'm going to make is that I want that this view of free will or of unpredictability is intelligible, and I want to clarify very clearly that I'm not going to try to persuade you that this is a true view of the world. So it's not going to be a metaphysical argument. I'm not going to even try to make the modest point of trying to persuade you that it is plausible to accept that as a good description of how actions are in the real world. Instead, I personally kind of, it's more, I think, question of belief or faith rather than any substantive argument, but I think that if we are free, that is the meaning that should be attributed to the term, but I'm not going to pursue any of these points. So if you think that this is an unplausible view of freedom, I'm not going to challenge that. What I do want to suggest that even if you think that, there are good reasons for criminal law to adhere to this view and to adopt it, even if this view is false or implausible. And I'm going to try to raise two arguments. First one is in the paper, second one is the new one, about why criminal law should take this stance, even if it is if it doesn't describe the type of freedom that we have, and even if you think that it is implausible that we actually have that type of freedom. So I'm going. So this is kind of the three stages we're going to make. I'm going to do a very brief presentation of the first stage, just to kind of to show you how the argument basically works, and then talk a bit more about the intelligibility of the concept, just to explain what do I mean by unpredictable. And then I'm going to focus mainly on the third part, try to elaborate on the two reasons that we that I think that should lead criminal law to adopt that view. Okay, so first stage. So the first step in kind of explaining how this view justifies or explains why the hostility of criminal law is to try to or to note that prediction of human conduct requires some reliance on causal generalization, and that the connection could be either direct or indirect, so it could be either via a third principle or not. But this is, as you some of you might be familiar, the principle of other principle of common cause, and basically in other words, or maybe an implication of that, is to say that statistical significance in and of itself is insignificant, is insufficient to distinguish between informative and spurious correlation. So you need to assume that there is a causal connection, and for example, the one here. So basically, there's a beautiful website that lists all these very impressive statistically significant correlations that are clearly non-causal. For example, apparently there's a very strong correlation between the amount of margarine sold in the state of Maine and the number of people drawn to death in their private pools. There's also a very strong correlation between a number of pictures of films that Nicolas Cage appears in and the number of divorces that people achieve in another country. Well, this is maybe some hidden causal connection, so I'm not sure about that. But basically, the idea here is to collect all these sort of examples that show that we need to have an additional criterion other than statistical significance, and it's clearly that any kind of attempt to look into this data and say, okay, now I know to predict based on the amount of margarine sold, how many people will be dying in drowning in the swimming pool next year, is not going to make it. We look for other type of explanations. So I'm going to. So that's what stands kind of at the basis of my assumption that we need a causal generalization. And then the next step is to try to show that if, based on that assumption, if we take, for example, a case in which someone, let's say there's a certain type of radiation which causes people to act violently and also creates certain skin marks. So, and this is deterministically, so every time somebody is exposed to that radiation, he or she develops both of the symptoms, then if we want to put someone to trial and he denies that it was him that assaulted another person, and we want to use that skin marks in order to show that it was him rather than another suspect who acted violently, then it will prove that it was indeed him, but it will do so by also showing us that he acted unfreely, and that would basically undermine his criminal liability. So that's one example, and obviously this is a very simplistic one. Usually generalizations we use are probabilistic, so we usually say that most of the people, so everybody would show the skin marks, but amongst the people who show the skin marks, let's say only 20% or 80% acted acted valiantly and 20% didn't. So we want to say, look, this raises significantly the probability, put aside the kind of the exact population, but this is significantly raises the probability of that it was him rather than the other suspect. But then again, what I tried to show in the paper, that it's either that he belongs to two groups. So we need to divide the population into two subgroups. So 80% of the people were caused by the radiation, and 20% had another variables which caused the radiation, or which made the radiation ineffective on them. And then either he belongs to the first subgroup of people who were caused to act in a particular way, or he belonged to the other subgroup in which the evidence is irrelevant. So this is basically very quickly just try to show the type of the argument, and then I try to apply that on DNA evidence and show that the unlike other attempts to explain what is wrong with predictive evidence, this account doesn't apply to DNA evidence because there's no causal connection between me having a certain DNA and me committing the crime. It's actually a sort of a trace evidence, and the statistical part doesn't change that fact, and also explain what is wrong with previous convictions. So again, all of that was very quickly, just to summarize what's in the paper, if you didn't follow the argument, so all what I need you to accept at that stage, that or not to accept, just to assume that if we assume this view that I'm going to elaborate on in a minute, we have a possible explanation for why, and justification perhaps for why criminal justice systems are so hostile to predictive evidence. So that's basically the function of the first part, which I just very briefly try to summarize. So what is this kind of unpredictability condition assumed? Before I explain that, I'm going to do what follow on David's proposal and to try to highlight exactly differences between what perhaps some of you would think about what free actions should be, or should what type or tokens of free action, so the concept of free action should cover. And I want to make the following few clarifications. So under this theory of unpredictable free will, free actions become a much narrower class than what we would think of. So there would be less of them, both in terms of quantity and in terms of types. And I want to go into three differences. So I'm only, so when I'm going to talk about free actions under this kind of a view, I'm only going to talk about actions that are actually maybe only maybe culpable or appraisable. So for example, the fact that Google predicts exactly what I'm going to want to search for is for me outside of the scope. So the fact that Google is so great in predicting that is great, but this is not the type of actions neither me nor criminal law usually are interested in. Similarly, I can tell you with almost certainty that tomorrow I'll drink coffee, and nevertheless you can consider that as a free action according to some respects, but this is not the actions I'm going to cover. And I also don't think that they're free in the sense that this account tries to capture, so that's one thing. Second thing is that I'm only going to cover actions that the agent has subjective reasons to perform. So, to take Victor Tadros' example, the fact that I'm not now jumping on the table and start dancing or something like that is perhaps a free action, the fact that I'm avoiding that. But for me, or the fact that I'm not going out and start killing people, but that's, I would say this is not the type of actions or the type of things that I think fall into the category of reactions that I'm going to focus on, because the agent, or me in that particular case, has no reason whatsoever to do so. So I don't face any basically any reason or any conflict in order to do so, and that brings me to the first limitation, that I'm focusing on deliberated action. So action that follow certain deliberation. What counts under deliberation? How long should it be? How thorough? How rational? Etc. These are huge questions. I'm not going to assume anything about that. All what I'm going to assume is that if you have certain actions that you do automatically, without even thinking, that's not the actions I'm talking about, and I'm not saying that you cannot be culpable for them, but if you are culpable for them, I would suggest that this is a derivative culpability, because you adopted a certain habit, because you put yourself in a dangerous situation in which you were in the position of not thinking about it, and thinking about drinking and driving and things like that. And so on and so on. But again, this is kind of a type of actions, I think, it raises a challenge to criminal law. If you want to criminalize that sort of actions, there's some explanation to make, so I'm not going to focus on them, and more needs to be said about that. So I'm going to focus on a very narrow class on deliberate action that the agent has subjective reasons to perform, and that action could be subject to attribution of culpability or blame. So this is basically the preliminary, just to try to look at the type of actions that I'm going to. Actions and omission in that respect are for me similar, although I understand that some think that there are some moral differences between acting and omitting to act. I'm not going to discuss that here. So what is the predictability condition? It's basically the view that free actions lack either subjective or objective probabilities. So if you look at the agent and try to figure out whether, so we have an agent who deliberates whether to perform a certain to commit a certain crime. So prior to his choosing to commit that crime, there is no probability that could be assigned to him either choosing to commit the crime or to refrain from committing the crime. And it's not just merely lack of knowledge or lack of evidence or lack of, ability to draw this inference. So it's not merely subjective. The claim is stronger, is to say that there's actually no such probability that could be attached to such a view. Those who kind of are familiar with the literature, they're kind of classifying this theory as incompatibilist with the idea of the world is deterministic and we could nevertheless be free. It's therefore falls as a libertarian, not in the political sense, but in the free will metaphysical sense. And I'm going to focus on what is called an agent causalist, which is a very specific type of libertarian theories of free will, which says that the agent himself causes the action, and nothing causes the agent, or I'll talk about that in a minute, but according to my view, nothing causes the agent to perform or to choose one course of action than another. But notice that I'm not taking the modern turn in this type of literature. So most of contemporaries who argue or suggest or hint toward a sort of Peter Ruggen, I'm not sure how to classify him, but certainly Timothy O'Connor argue for a libertarian theory of free will in which we have objective probabilities for certain type of actions, but I'm going to stick with or to follow someone who is perhaps in Spain is more known than in Israel, but Henry Bergson's view of kind of no objective probabilities for free action sort of view. Okay, so that's basically kind of the metaphysics of or what do I assume. And again, I'm not trying to persuade you that this is plausible or this is the type of theory we have. All what I'm trying to show you now, or will try to show you now, is that it's intelligible. that you can understand how free actions or walk under this type of theory, and whether or not that theory holds in our world or not is not part of what I'm trying to do. So, two things we need to say. What are subjective reasons under this theory? And the important thing to note here is that reasons are not causes. So against the kind of the well accepted, or, I don't know, popular or dominant Davidsonian view that reasons are causes, or at least reason explanations are causal in nature, this theory, and I'm not alone here, it's several libertarian theories take this kind of view on reasons. Reasons are not causes. So it's not like I'm the agent standing here and there's some reason that pushes me toward that direction, pushes me toward and others toward the other directions, and the stronger reasons prevail and causes me, the agent, to do certain action. This is not the view. Instead, the view I'm going to suggest is that reasons are enablers. What are enablers? So this is coming from the metaphysics of causation view. This is not Lombard's own view about reasons, but this is kind of my adaptation of his view. But if you think about the role of oxygen in a fire, so some people would say that the oxygen is the cause of the fire, but other metaphysicians would say that this is not the cause, but merely a background condition. So without oxygen, there will be no fire, but it's not that type of cause, and there's a certain attempt to make a distinction between causes and conditions, or the fact that I was murdered, the fact that I was born is obviously a necessary condition for me being murdered, but it's not the cause of my death. So that's kind of an attempt that is being made, and there's some obvious objections that could be made about it and so on, but that's the point I want to highlight here is that reasons are enablers. So I have reasons to, if I deliberate whether to commit a crime or not, I have some reasons to perform the crimes, and I have other reasons to not perform the crime, and basically the fact that I have the conflicting reasons, this is what enable the agent choice between the two. So that's why I said that you need. That's why I assume that you need conflicting reasons either to commit the crime and to refrain from it, either there is no free choice. So last thing about rational explanation. So if we understand free actions like that, then we could say that free actions have rational explanations. So if I'll take the example of Breuer, somebody stands being caught in front of the post office with kind of a sign, this is a robbery, please hand me all your money, but he's been caught after he came back and forth several times, and then he's been caught, and we could understand, assuming if he were to indeed go inside, or try to go inside rather than being stopped at the entrance, we could understand this choice as rational because he probably needs money, he probably wants to better get rich or whatever, so it would be rational for him to go inside. But it will, if he would also eventually decide to go on and give up the whole idea, it would also be rational because he have other reasons to refrain from the crime. He's afraid of getting caught, doesn't want to hurt people, whatever. What we don't have is a contrasted explanation. So we cannot explain why eventually he chose A rather than B. Why, if he decided to go inside, why he decided to rob the bank or not. The only thing that we could say, he robbed the bank because this is what he chose eventually. He preferred these reasons over the other. And there's no third line of reasons or second order reasons why he preferred the first reason rather than the second. So this is basically the view, and again, I went over it quickly, but not quickly enough, and I want to spend the remaining 12 minutes or so to look into the reasons why criminal law should adopt this view. And the idea here is that we have that we have various legal concepts that do not try to track the true meaning of the concept, or the kind of the ordinary language, or the way it is used in ordinary language, or perhaps even the kind of the best philosophically defensible conceptualization. Instead, sometimes we have certain concepts that are being used in law that try to maintain certain fictions. In some cases, for example, legal causation, every time we put legal in front of something, usually lawyers think that we can do with the concept whatever we like. So we put legal causation, and now we can... And in contrast to factual causation, which is usually what philosophers of causation are interested in when we look into the law. So we look into legal causation, we can do a lot with it. We look about knowledge of the law. The fact that my ignorance of the law is not an excuse is probably the biggest fiction I know, because I teach criminal law and I can't say that I know every bit and piece of the criminal code. So it's probably not true to say that every person in the country knows or can be knows the prohibitions and their exact boundaries, but nevertheless we adopt this this presumption. So what I'm going to do is to try to suggest that that law should treat culpable free actions as unpredictable, even if they are predictable. So I'm going to suggest sort of a construction that, again, doesn't depend on the view being correct. So, two reasons. First is that using evidence, using predictive evidence, which treats the action as predictable, impairs or undermines the effectiveness of stigmatization. I'm going to assume very quickly that free will is appropriate for moral condemnation, so you can only condemn a free action, and if it's unfree, then it should not be condemned. And I'm going to also assume that stigmatization is part of the main functions of criminal law, either as a standalone, kind of we think this is desirable, or because we need it to achieve deterrence, because we need it as part of our properly punish the criminal as he or she deserves, and so on. But stigmatization is a very important part of the kind of the aims of criminal law. And how does the justification work? So we start with looking what kind of a very, for me, weird branch of philosophy, which is experimental philosophy, is doing. And there were kind of a group of or series of experiments trying to answer the question, how do ordinary people, or lay people, rather than trained philosophers, how they view free will? So incompatibilists usually assume that people start as a natural incompatibilist, like Kane, and then there were some really interesting experiments by Nachmias and partners to show that actually it's not as intuitive. So perhaps ordinary people do view free will as compatibilist, and there were some comeback kind of third or second generation experiment try to show that some experiments reveals that lay people consider human decision making as something which is not subject to causal law and not determined by the past. And the argument continues, and I'm not trying to take any particular stand, but I think if you look at one type kind of or way, a simple attempt to suggest why the law should treat people as unpredictable, is that if we have a significant proportion of the public that holds the view that culpable action are unpredictable, then once we use predictive evidence, which assumes that that's the opposite, we basically undermine the claim that accuses guilty of committing the crime freely. And we can also cite some experiments that try to show that people who believe in free will tend to, act more according to certain moral norms more frequently than people who do not believe in free will. So believing in free will correlates or encourages people, arguably, to act more lawfully, you could say. And this sort of explanations could appeal to people who are what is called freedom skeptics. So people who believe that we don't have free will, but like Solzhenitsyn from Haifa, who would say that we should nevertheless encourage people to believe in this myth or because that would otherwise the whole society would fall apart, and so on. So this is kind of a possible line of argument. Of course, it's not clear how many people in, or what proportion of people in our society really believe that our free actions are unpredictable, and it's also unclear whether it was the price, because we sacrifice accuracy, and therefore it means that we have more guilty people against the law and more innocent perhaps being acquitted. I'll say something about it at the end. But perhaps for me the strongest objection is that this argument is very manipulative. So somebody puts this argument saying that I know better, but I think that the plebs should be encouraged to believe what I think is false, just in order to kind of keep them in line. So I think this is a very strong argument. I want to try to suggest something more refined by looking in a phenomenon called bypassing. And bypassing is the idea that or some of the explanations that made by compatibilists to explain why we see some findings that show that people think that we are not caused by other things, is that because they confuse it with bypassing, which is the phenomena that one actions are not causally dependent on mental state processes and beliefs, desires, deliberation, and so on. And obviously the most familiar one is fatalism. It means that no matter what will happen, I will do something or something will happen, no matter what the agent will do, desire, decide, and so on. And this is, of course, not an implication of compatibilism. So I'm not saying that this is what compatibilism amounts to. But the idea here is that people are confusing compatibilism with this notion of bypassing, and that's what causes them to opt for the other side. And what I want to suggest is that because we have this common confusion, so there's a risk that people will misunderstand predictive evidence as implying or showing bypassing, even if it not necessarily do so. And this is because predictive evidence requires a causal connection between some factor, which is usually or almost always outside the agent's control, and their conduct. So think about the crime rates in the beginning. Why do we think that, if we think that this is predictive of a particular member of or resident of this neighborhood, even though he was not included in the original sampling, is because probably we think there's some underlying causal mechanism, something about perhaps the dangerous character of the neighborhood that causes people to engage in violent activity, or socioeconomic factors or conditions, and so on. And this usually are outside of the agent's control, and therefore they elicit or might encourage people to adopt bypassing. So basically that's an attempt to try to explain why criminal law should treat people as unpredictable free will, because the concern that if we will treat them as predictable and we use evidence to establish that, this might be misinterpreted as bypassing, and therefore we should put that sort of evidence, or not use that sort of evidence, at least until we are able to educate people otherwise, or at least until we are able to construct evidence in a way or that is not prone to such a misinterpretation. Okay, now, in the last 2 minutes I have, I want to just briefly go on the topic that I'm going to
five,
okay, good. So let's assume, for the sake of the argument, that when a person decides or stands before a decision whether to commit a crime or to refrain from the crime, he's causally influenced by factors outside of their control. It could be genetics, it could be upbringing, it could be socioeconomic conditions, and perhaps even, and I want you to entertain the option that perhaps even things like gender, race, religion, etc. might have causal influence on our decision whether to act in one particular way or another. Now, ideally, if such evidence is going to be used both skillfully, professionally, responsibly, etc., so perhaps such kind of evidence that connects between these factors and criminal conduct could assist fact finders in finding the truth, because otherwise it indicates a certain causal connection, which is indeed probative and helpful. And usually when I talk about it with my students, it doesn't happen a lot, but usually if there is some resistance, I invite people to think about the situation outside of the criminal court. So if you walk in a dark alley and somebody is walking behind you and you know that he has certain characteristics that is highly associated with, let's say, the criminal conduct of robbery, would it be rational for you to take that information into account when deciding whether to flee or to stop a nearby taxi or something like that? So I want to clean that from anything that we talk about blame or culpability. Instead of that, as since as information, if I'm trying to decide whether I'm in risk of being robbed, if indeed there is this causal connection and I have good and reliable evidence to indicate exactly what extent of the risk, it seems that even if it doesn't prove to me that this person is going to commit that crime, it seems information that I would like to have when needing to decide whether I'm going to spend money on a taxi now, yes or no. Okay, so if you accept this, then perhaps, we need to answer why we shouldn't do that in the court. And here is yet another attempt. So perhaps by excluding predictive evidence, criminal law treats all people as equal. And the idea here is that under the view that I just put forward, which again, implausible as it might be looked to you, the idea here is that the agent is being treated as an abstract, out-of-context, thin agent that is not being influenced by the social and biological and any other conditions that he is acting on. But instead of that, he's going to be this agent that causes the action out of the blue. And the only evidence that can be used against him is the evidence of that is created by his action. And rather than any evidence that try to take into account the conditions under which he is he's operating. I know that it is true, kind of this kind of we all kind of at least in Tel Aviv it's very common response to say that we need to look at things in context and we need to understand the circumstances, the full circumstances under which people are operating. And what I'm inviting you to do is not to deny that view. And I realize that it's looking kind of from people outside of context and is actually perhaps not the way things work. Perhaps it is true that when we decide how to act, we are being causally influenced by many factors outside of our control. However, what I suggest is that criminal law should nevertheless assume the opposite, that we are isolated from all these influences and basically take that and rely that on as a fiction, but as a desirable fiction to rely on, because this way all of us are treated exactly the same, irrespective of the circumstances under which we were brought up, growing up, our genetics, our socioeconomic conditions, and so on. So there's a very strong sense of equality in this treatment. So this is kind of the direction I'm considering to take, and I'd be happy to hear what you think, whether it's entirely crazy or only half of it. So thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to...